In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's time for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be speaking today with Carla Olson, who first came to prominence in the 1980s, fronting the band The Textones, and since her career has included working with and producing the likes of Mick Taylor, Gene Clark, Alan Clark, Eric Clapton, and a host of other greats. Her latest single is It True?, done first by Brenda Lee in the 60s, and features her backed by Tall Poppy Syndrome. It's a recent coolest song in the world. I'll play some of it now, followed by my chat with Carla on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. The Mighty Manfred, and it's time now for your Friday's Coolest Conversations. Joining me is singer, songwriter, and producer Carla Olson. She first came to prominence with her band The Textones back in the 1980s, and since then she's worked with all sorts of artists, including Mick Taylor, Percy Sledge, Ry Cooter, Gene Clark, Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, John Fogerty, just a host of greats. And what brings her to our attention today is that she sings lead on our coolest song in the world this week. It's a version of the Brenda Lee 60s hit, Is It True? And on it, she's backed by the group Tall Poppy Syndrome. How are you, Carla?
Excellent, excellent. Beautiful, sunshiny day.
That's right. That's right. I'm here with you. Now, I'm going to ask you, though, first, I know you've been in L.A. for a long while, but you grew up in Austin, in Texas, is what I've read. Is that right?
Yes. I was born in Austin and came out here in 1978, I guess, with my confidant, Kathy Valentine, and we started a band called The Textones out here in L.A., so it's been a wild number of years.
So. Right, well, before we get you out to L.A., I mean, these days, you know, Austin has got a reputation worldwide as a music capital, as well as being the state capital there in Texas, but as you were growing up, were you aware of any music scene going on in the city?
Well, there were several. I'm kind of old, you know, man. I go back to the 60s in Austin as far as the music scene. And we had a pretty healthy music scene in the 60s there because we had a lot of bands that were, they fed into other, you know, acts and stuff. I know but Don Henley's band played down in Austin. He was from Denton up in around Dallas. And they would come down every weekend and play clubs and play fraternity parties. And we would go see them doing everything from the Box Top to, you know, to the Rascals. I mean, that's the kind of stuff they were doing. So, but the bands that I grew up listening to, besides Jimmy Vaughn and the Fabulous Thunderbirds and some of the more cutting edge bands later on in the punk scene. I mean, we had a pretty healthy scene for a long time in Austin. We had a great pop scene.
Did you ever see the 13th Floor Elevators?
Many times. I was really good friends with Donnie Erickson, Rocky, one of his little brothers, and Donnie had a band and was a guitar player in a band, and we used to hang around together, and Rocky was, Rocky kind of had jettisoned out of Austin. You know, by the time I got into high school, he was already out in San Francisco and doing that West Coast thing with the psychedelic movement and stuff, but yeah, I knew all those guys, and really, really kind of my my neighborhood, as they would say.
Well, you're talking about, you know, all these bands you would be checking out, and of course your career since. So in your household, as you grew up, was there a lot of music present? I mean, did your were your parents playing music, or what was the what was the house?
My dad was a my dad grew up in the Jamestown, New York area, and was a organist for the church there, and the classical he was a classical musician, and he also played piano in a up in Lake Chautauqua for the big band. They would have women, you know, would come in, singers and stuff, and he would back up the singer. And then during the war, when he went to South Pacific during the war, he played piano with the band, you know, that the guys had there. And then when he came back to Austin, he married my mom before the war, well, during the war. And she was from around, Bastrop actually is where she's from, outside of Austin. And they settled there and raised, you know, the three kids, and I was the third kid, and I was a lucky one because I got the piano. My brother got the violin.
Well, did you guys have a say what instrument you were getting?
No, but you know, there were I started playing the piano the minute my dad's piano the minute that they opened the top of it. I really set myself on the stool there and started to learn how to play. But I have to say that what turned me on to music and made me decide to go in that direction was my dad called me in 1963, I guess it was, or 64 it was, and said, "I want you to see this on TV." And it was the Beatles. And the minute I saw that group, I wanted to be in a band. You know, I wanted to play in a band. And it was all I could think about. So, and my parents were really great. My dad helped me get my first guitar, and you know, my first guitar was a green stamp guitar. It was an old, you know, one of those things you pick one out of a prize out of the booklet, and they put the stamps in there and took it down to the store, and they gave you whatever you wanted, whether it was a BB gun or a guitar. And I picked up a guitar. I guess I was probably 1965. It was.
So this is pretty great, because I was going to ask, you know, since your father had this background in classical music, if he was sort of down on rock and roll stuff, but it seems like your parents were pretty supportive of your music endeavors overall.
They were great. Yeah, both my mom and dad. My mom was one of the first women business owners in the decorating field in Austin in 1959. She had her own business, so she was real, you know, kind of like, I mean, my dad was the father of the family, but my mom was kind of like the second man in the family, you know.
Well, before we get you out to LA, there was I saw a story, and I hope you don't mind recounting it. It had to do with like Jimi Hendrix was playing in town, or he was playing in Houston or something. And can you recount that story where you caught Jimmy jamming late at night?
I always tell, I didn't start telling this story for years because a lot of people wouldn't believe you, but my friend and I, John Sahaley, he was a year older than me. He had a driver's license. He was 16 and I was 15, and we drove down to San Antonio, which is, it's only 90 miles, but drove down to San Antonio to see Jimi Hendrix. The first time in 68 was in February. The second time was in August. And the second time we drove down earlier, we thought we'd get there early. And we it was a very small venue on 3,000 seater. And we went around to the back of the hall, and they were loading in the gear in the afternoon. And there was a problem with, I guess they had the night before, they'd had all of Jimmy's Stratocaster cases were stolen. And they thought they had the guitars, but they didn't. They just had the cases, the guitars that needed cases. So we helped them get to the music store to buy the guitar cases for his Strat. And they said, "Why don't you stay and hang out with us and, you know, have dinner and stuff?" So we did that. And after the show, they said, you know, after the show, come back up to the hotel and you know, you can hang out with us. So we did that. And Jimmy invited us into the presidential suite of the hotel. And we were sitting around listening to music. And he was talking to guitars with my buddy. And I was talking to Mitch Mitchell about the blues musicians that came around Austin and San Antonio. They didn't get that in England. I mean, we were so lucky. We had Muddy Waters and We had T-Bone Walker and all these people that would come through once a week and play, you know, in Austin and Houston and San Antonio. And they were like thrilled to meet us because we were like, even though we were little kids, we had something they didn't have. You know, we had the Chitlin Circuit.
Yeah.
And so when Jimmy decided that he you know, it was about midnight. You know, shows got over. It was 10 o'clock, you know. And he wanted to go somewhere and play and jam. So we took him to the newly opened World's Fair, had opened a couple of days before. And they had a club that was open until 4 a.m. And some friends of ours were playing there. And we took him there to jam with this band. And he and Mitch, they both went. And he walked up on stage and picked up my friend's 335 and right-handed and played it left-handed, played it right-handed. He was ambidextrous.
Right.
And they played for about five songs, and then, you know, we helped them get back to the hotel, and it was wonderful. What can I say? And there were so many great things about that story. I remember Jimmy said, I want to play you guys. When he was in the room, the hotel room, he said, I want to play you guys an album that had I've just gotten, and it's not even out yet. And he says, this is the best living guitar player. And it was Jeff Beck's Truth album.
Oh, wow.
And I got to share that with Jeff Beck about 6 years later in Austin when he came through and was playing in town, and the tears just welled up in his eyes. And
oh.
In retrospect now, I think about those days, and it was a beautiful, sweet memory for me. And I like to tell that story now because people don't believe that things like that happen to young kids, that, you know, when these bands are on the road and come around to your town, they just think it's all like groupies and sex and drugs and stuff. And it's not all just that. I mean, some of it was that, but not for me, but some of it was for that. But we had some really great bands that came through. Austin, you know, was a smaller venue. You couldn't really get some of the bigger acts. They had it. The Stones never came to Austin until the 90s, you know, because there was never a venue big enough. So, but that's my Jimi Hendrix story.
That's a great one. That's a great one. Thanks for sharing it. So let's get you on out to LA. You mentioned Kathy Valentine, you know, later of the Go-Go's, but she was with you in the Textones. So did the Textones form in Austin, or do you did that after you guys were out in Los Angeles in 78?
Well, the skinny of it is that Kathy and I started playing together. She and I both had been in England separately, didn't know each other. And then when we found ourselves back in Austin and had mutual friends, and we just started hanging out and playing. And, you know, I had a Marshall stack and she had a basement, and we were like, you know, chicks with big amps, what can I say? And, We started playing together, and we formed a band called The Violators. And her friend played drums that she grew up with, another woman. And we had Jesse Sublette, who played bass, who went on to form a band called The Skunks. And all these bands had sort of all been turned on to punk music in one way or another. And in Austin, we didn't really have that yet. And we were the first band that played at Raul's, which is kind of a infamous club. Matter of fact, I have done the serious show Cow Punks and Now Punks with one of your wonderful DJs on there. We've talked about this for 2 hours, how we brought that sort of punkism to L.A. and kind of found ourselves right in the middle of the new wave scene.
Yeah.
And when we got out to L.A., the other two people didn't come. It was just Kathy and I.
Mm-hmm.
And we started looking for a bass player and drummer and found a name, the Textones, because we were from Texas. So that's the story.
It was a story. And you did a couple of albums in the 80s. What brought the Textones to an end?
Well, it wasn't really an end. I think Kathy joined the Go-Go's, and then I carried the band on 3-piece. And with Dave Provost, who later was with the Dream Syndicate, and Marcus Cuff, who had been Emmy Lou Harris's Angel Band drummer, and he and I and Dave, we had a 3-piece, and we played the Whiskey and the Starwood and different places. And then I think that at one point they moved on to other bands, and I got Phil Seymour playing drums, if you remember the Dwight Twilley band.
Right, right. He was a drummer then. Yeah, yeah. And he had great shirts. He had these great striped shirts.
You know? He had his striped shirts, exactly. Yeah, his Brian Jones look. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we met up with Joe Reed, who was in a band from England at that time. And he was in L.A., and we started playing and formed the Texans. We recorded two albums, one for A&M and another one for Enigma. And then I think I was just starting to do stuff on my own a bit with Gene Clark and from the Byrds and Mick Taylor from the Rolling Stones. We had done some solo projects together. And I think that the band we didn't break up. We just stopped recording together and stopped playing, you know, gigs, and they kind of moved in other directions. So that's what happened. But we did a reunion album in 2018. We recorded a reunion album. So, you know,
well, who all played? Does Dave play on that? Prevost, does he play on the reunion album?
He does, but on one song, it's all of us. It's Kathy, me, Dave, Mark, Phil Seymour had passed away, but we had a recording of him that I incorporated into the album. Yeah, we're all on it. Everybody's on it.
Well, you touched on a couple of things that, you know, you start working with these other people, and you mentioned both Gene Clark and Mick Taylor, and I want to touch on those real quick. So how did you get working with Gene Clark? What was the introduction to be able to work with him?
Well, I bought those first two albums, the Byrds albums, Tambourine Man and Turn, 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 through the Columbia Record Club back then. You could get, you know, 10 albums for, I don't know, $5.99 or something.
Right, and like a penny a piece after that, or a nickel a piece
after? It was a penny a piece, exactly. And if you got 10 albums, you got a little record rack that came with it, a little brass record rack you could set the albums in. And I was really always a Byrds fan, and a huge Byrds fan. And I met Gene through, oddly, at a club. My manager and I went to see his band at the time. They were calling themselves the Firebirds. And we went to see them, and a guy that was a Texans fan was friends with Gene, and he pulled me up on stage to sing on the encore that they were doing. It was a Bird song, Feel a Whole Lot Better, and Gene had written that. And I was singing with him, and the next thing I know is we're talking backstage, and he needed the manager, and my manager got involved with him, and that's kind of how I met him. But and we used to go over to his house all the time, and one time we were just sitting around strumming guitars and singing together, and Gene says, "We ought to record an album," and I said, "That sounds great, let's do it." So we did. That's how it came about.
And the Mick Taylor story, how about Mick Taylor, because that's pretty wild too.
Well, once again, I was a huge John Mayall, the Blues Breakers fan, huge. And that was like one of the Peter Green and Mick Taylor and Clapton. Those guys were my favorite.
Well, what's funny, what's great about that, I'm interrupting because what's great about that is that you said, you know, I was a big John Mayall fan, and he wasn't straight to the Stones, you know, which is, except for that, it's great. But that's that just kind of, again, illustrates, you know, your the breadth of your music interests. And again, tying back to the blues, I think it's very cool. Yeah, Peter Green too, and all that.
You got to remember, I'm from Central Texas, and in that area at the time, the blues was kind of king, you know. And I mean, people were Freddie King and BB and Albert Collins. All those guys were coming around. They were all playing in Austin. That was kind of one of the main places, and that they could get good money. And I remember one night seeing Johnny Winter was playing at this place, the Vulcan Gas Company, and Muddy Waters, he was opening for Muddy Waters, and Muddy Waters came in and saw this albino on stage playing blues as good as they get. And he became a huge Johnny advocate. And that's how Johnny Winter ended up producing a Muddy Waters album.
Right.
Wow. Was that whole Central Texas Austin scene wasn't just all about Stevie Ray Vaughan. Stevie Ray Vaughan was part of it later. But it all started at the Chitlin. Austin was on the Chitlin circuit, and we got all of the best blues bands coming through town, and all the West Coast people like Poco And you got, you know, people like the Burrito Brothers, and they all came through and played in Austin because it was the hip place, and the college was there, university was there, and we got a lot of the stuff that that Dallas and San Antonio did not get. So yeah, and I love people like that. I love Peter Green is probably my favorite guitar player ever, and he was the best. And Mick Taylor, of course, too. So when I met Mick Taylor, the first time he was playing a reunion gig with Don Mayall down at the Golden Bear, which is a club down in on the beach, Huntington Beach. We went down to see that show, and I introduced myself to him, and I had Eric Johnson with me, who I grew up with. We went to high school together, and Eric wanted to meet him, and we were talking to Mick, and then the next thing I know, Mick is in Bob Dylan's album, Infidels album, and a friend of mine was a Texones fan, and he said that Bob was going to do a video, and would I like to pantomime Mick Taylor's guitar parts in the video because Mick was in England? And I said, "Are you kidding? Of course, you know." So that's how I got in the video, which is in A Sweetheart Like You. I'm in that video. It's not me playing, but I'm pantomiming to the best of my ability the Mick Taylor parts. And then that's how I met Mick again. That, you know, he and Bob came to see us play, the Texones play down in Santa Monica at a big club that was there called Music Machine. And we were opening for the Blasters. And they came and sat and watched us. And then Nick got in touch with me and said, "I'd like to do a record with you." And that's how it happened.
Well, all right. We got to focus some on our coolest song in the world this week, right? Your version of Is It True?
Coolest song, Ben. Is that the coolest thing?
Yeah, it is cool. Okay, so Brenda Lee did this tune back in 1964. Is It True? And she had like a top 20 hit with it in the U.S. They like flew her to England. She was big in England and all that original recording. It's like Jimmy Page playing guitar and these Ken Lewis, John Carter, the songwriters, they were in this, the Ivy League was their English group at the time, but they wrote some other really cool songs like A Little Bit of Soul that the Music Explosion would have a hit with. They wrote some other cool stuff. All right. So, and your version features you playing or being backed by the Tall Poppy Syndrome. So, those guys, Paul Kopf, lead singer, Vince Maloney from the Bee Gees on guitar, Jonathan Lay on
Jonathan
electric,
Lay.
On electric guitar, Alec Paolo on bass, Clem Burke from Blondie on the drums. Now, so what's your connection to the Tall Poppy Syndrome? How'd you wind up working with these guys on it?
Well, probably earliest on, I knew Clem back in the late 70s. Clem from Blondie, they came through, and Kathy and I kind of befriended them because we were the Austin counterparts to what was going on in New York. And I've probably known Vince Maloney maybe through my husband and manager through the 70s. He worked for the Bee Gees in the 70s and did some different things for them and became, you know, friends with Vince. And Vince used to come to L.A., he would always get in touch with my husband. But Jonathan Lay and I've been friends, I don't know, I guess since the 80s, something like that. And he has that other band, Jigsaw Scene, and we did a lot of shows with them, some parody stuff for different entities together. And he started this other band. He just, you know, put it together with Alec Palau and Paul Kopf, and Vince Maloney was the chosen guitar player. Actually, Jonathan Lay met Vince through Saul and I, through my husband and I. But Jonathan, he's the one that heard, we've been talking about doing something for a while together, and having me sing lead on something, and they were going to back me up. And we kind of didn't really find the right song until one day he was looking at Jimmy Page's post about that song, about the Is It True? And that, you know, he was a hot session guy before he was in the Yardbirds. He was a hot session guy around London and got some work. And that was one of the songs he played on. So he was playing it on his social media page. And then coincidentally, the same day on Sirius XM, Palmyra was playing it. So it was sort of like, Providence, Jonathan Lay said, "I think we got to cut this tongue." So that's how it came about. It was sort of one of those, woo, you know.
Well, so who produced the recording?
We co-produced it with Mark Wheaton, and Mark Wheaton is the where we cut it at his studio up in close to you, actually, up in Echo Park. And he's what would I call one of those guys that grew up in the LA punk scene along the time when Kathy and I first got here. He was one of the guys that was in a couple of pivotal bands back then. And we just went in, and we're all in different places. Vince was in London, and it was Clem and Jonathan Lay and me who went in to cut a track, and I sang a crack vocal for them so they could put it down, get the rhythm section down, and then we sent it up to Alec Palau up in San Francisco, and he put the bass on it, and Paul was here, and he sang all the background parts. So we kind of, it's a hodgepodge, but it turned out really cool, and actually it's kind of edgy, you know, because we weren't all trying to get it all perfect. So I think that's what we were going for, was kind of a little, you know, bit of a rave up.
Well, let me ask you then. So this sounds great. Are you thinking of trying to work with do any more songs with Tall Poppy Syndrome?
Well, if we can find the right song that makes sense, or somebody, you know, if I write something or we put something together, and if Vince can come to LA, it'd be lot easier for us to do it all together. But if we don't, you know, we've always got the file sharing situation, which is not the way that I prefer to do things, but it turned out really well. So, you know, you just never know. We'll try to get something else out. It'll be fun. Yeah.
Well, it seems like you're really great about, you know, somebody says, "Hey, let's do something," that you try and figure out a way to do it. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think COVID provided that platform for all of us. We all had to learn how to do things a different way. I did a whole album worth of songs through my iPhone with a guy, Pete Brown, the writer.
Yeah, in fact, I'm just going to ask you about that. But before we get to Pete, I had noticed, I was looking up, what was it, like Brian Ray did a cover of, I think, Procol Harum song, Whiskey Town, and he's on Wicked Cool Records. But you sang lead on that. Is that right? I thought that was it.
You beat me to the punch, yeah. Actually, that was for an album I produced. He put it out on Wicked Cool, and then I also, he allowed us to use it for the Americana Railroad album, which I produced in 2021. Which has a variety of people on it, and that's got me thinking. Whiskey Train, yeah.
Yeah, Whiskey Train. I misspoke there. Yeah, thank you for correcting.
That's okay. Whiskey Town, Whiskey Train, whatever, you know.
I know. I mean, you know, taking the Whiskey Train to Whiskey Town, basically. All right. So, yeah, Pete Brown, the guy that he's the poet, he supplied the lyrics to like a bunch of Cream songs, working primarily with Jack Bruce. And they wrote like White Room and I Feel Free and SWLABR. How did this come together? So during lockdown, you guys somehow made a connection and started collaborating?
We had actually been introduced I knew of his music, obviously, because I was a huge Cream fan. And first album, second album, Disraeli Gears, he wrote most of those songs on Disraeli Gears, but the Cream songs. And I had produced an album for two albums, solo albums, for Paul Jones, the lead singer for Manfred Mann. And I had done one album in 2006 and another one I produced in 2016. And Paul used to have this radio show, much like you guys there. It was a blues show that he had on BBC Radio. He was every week on. And we used to listen on my computer to him Monday mornings at 11, he would be on. And especially after I knew him, it was him that introduced me to Pete Brown. Pete Brown came on and was interviewed by him for an hour and talked about all the songs he'd written. He wrote a lot for Procol Harum. He wrote a lot for Jack Bruce. And his writing partner, musician partner, had died. And he was talking about how sad he was that he didn't have anybody to write with anymore. And I just got in touch with Paul and I said, you know, if he wants a music partner, I said, I'm
here, and I'd love to write with him. He introduced me to Pete, and Pete started sending me lyrics. And before COVID, I got 7 sets of lyrics. And when I wrote the first song was in 2019, in the fall of 2019. Of course, we know what happened in the winter of 2020. And when we got locked down, there was nothing to do. You couldn't go to the studio. I couldn't go to the grocery store for about 4 months. You know that. We couldn't get toilet paper. I mean, you know, despite what many people want to think about it, it was certainly a time of reinvention, you know. And I started writing with my iPhone and my laptop and sending my demos to Joe Reed, my bass player from the Tech Zone. He was in London lockdown, and Pete was in Hastings lockdown, and we would send them back and forth, and then Pete would say yay or nay, and I need to add another verse or whatever. And literally I wrote all those songs during lockdown except for one, which I just finished recently. And sadly Pete passed away in 2023, not from COVID, but from cancer. And he fought it, and a gallant man and a poet, unbelievable poet, this guy, really. And I'm so thrilled to be finishing this record up myself. So when I'm done with that, I don't know what I'm going to find another project.
So Carla, what is the plan on that record? Will it come out? Is the hope that it will come out in later 2025 or?
Yes. I'm going to the studio today. I'm working on vocals. I'm getting ready to finish the 7th song of the ones that Pete and I wrote, and then I've got another song that I wrote about the experience of writing for someone and being, you know, we're the trio of the poet, the pauper, and the pen. You know, we put it all together through thick or thin, and I think that's the reinvention. Is people in the music business had to learn how to write and compose and collaborate in ways that we never dreamed when we were young that we would have that ability even. And it's not all my favorite way to do stuff, but it's what we had to do. So there you go.
Well, back in 2013, you did this album, Half Harmony Will Travel, featured you with a lot of talented folks. Volume 2 followed in 2020. This past fall saw the release of Volume 3, and these albums have featured you paired with the likes of Peter Case and Richie Farray, Scott Kempner, Terry Reid. The more recent one, Volume 3, has got Alan Clark, B.J. Thomas on there. What prompted this series to begin, the Half Harmony Will Travel?
Well, I love singing with people. I mean, playing alone is no fun, and singing alone is fine, but singing with someone and you have that same timbre or whatever, you know, your voices blend. And a coincidence is that Scott Kempner was the first one, Scott Kempner from the Del Lord, who passed away last year. He was the first person that said, I love to sing a duet with you, Carla, let's do it. So, and the song that I chose was a Little Steven song. It was a song called All I Needed Was You. And it was a song that he never, I don't, to my knowledge, never did it with the E Street Band. And we cut that, and Scott sings it and plays guitar on it. And that was the first one we did. The second one was Peter Case. And Peter, I've known since Plimsoll's days. We, you know, used to do gigs together, and we're very close friends. And I wanted to do songs that were either good to sing with somebody else or songs from my childhood. And the first album was mostly songs that I'd heard on the radio station in Austin, which is KNOW. And they played everything from Paul Murray's Love Is Blue to The Zombie. It was a great childhood to grow up, you know, hearing all these songs from various genres that mix together and become pop music. So that's how I started the first Half Harmony Will Travel. The second one was songs that I started that I had started with B.J. Thomas and Timothy Schmidt from the Eagles. We did a song together, a Buffalo Springfield song together, and we did the song that Jonathan Lay played 12-string guitar on, which was Peter Noon from Hermit's Hermit
I said, Pete, would you like to sing a song with me on this duet album? And he goes, yeah, if I can pick the song. So he picked Goodbye, My Love, which was a hit by the Searchers in England when he was growing up. So we kind of brought in our childhood favorite songs is what we did.
Well, so you mentioned the Peter Noone from Hermits. Hermits Volume 3 has got you singing with Alan Clark from the Hollies. I guess you'd call. So what the song that was like a single off there, It Makes Me Cry, that's the writing credit I see has got both of you listed. Is that correct? So both you guys contributed to Makes Me Cry?
I actually wrote lyrics back in the 80s for that song that was about the homeless, and it was about the struggle on the street, and you see it every day. We still see it every day here, and I'm sure around the world it's not gotten a whole lot different. And I wrote those lyrics, and I tried to put the music to it. And then Alan and I met through my husband, who was friends with the Hollies, all the guys in the Hollies, and from the 70s to the 80s to the 90s, and we Alan had decided he was going to not sing anymore because he couldn't sing in those keys that the Hollies did the songs in. And his wife was not doing well, and he decided he was going to retire for a while. And we kind of coaxed him back into the fold and said, you know, if you don't want to sing anymore, write some lyrics let's write some songs together. So we ended up writing two songs where he wrote the lyrics, I wrote the music, and then I sent him the lyrics to It Makes Me Cry. And he came back with this beautiful melody and singing. Beautiful song, and that's what we ended up. And he sent me the track, which was harmonica and a drum machine, and I got my band to record it, and we used his harmonica track, and we replaced his drum machine with a real band, and we sent it back to him, and he sang harmonies, and it was great. It was great. And Alan is a brilliant, brilliant singer, songwriter, and the Hollies are still out there touring. Go for it, you know.
Well, the track off the recent release, the recent Half Harmonies Will Travel, Volume 3, that I want us to go out with is your version of The Who's I Can See for Miles.
Favorite song The Who does.
That's right, yeah. Well, and so Gary Myrick is helping you out on your version. Can you remind me about Gary? Who's Gary? How'd you guys meet?
Gary's from Dallas. Gary's from Dallas, and I met him. He moved down to Austin in the early 70s. And I met him. He was playing in a band, and I gravitated to him because he loved T-Rex. I mean, he was like one of these guys with feather boas and the shag haircut and the whole thing. We got to be good friends, and we're still good friends. He lived down the road a piece. He used to live in Studio City, and we used to see him, you know, all the time here. Now he's living in Topanga, but we're good friends. He had a solo career in L.A. And had a hit with a song called He Talks in Stereo. And he also played in Big Audio Dynamite and Havana 3 a.m. with the guys from The Clash.
Wow, okay.
A couple of guys from The Clash. Yeah. Gary's great. Really cool. But he's a monster guitar player.
Your version of I Can See for Miles, right? It's a favorite song. Why does it wait for Volume 3?
Well, because I wanted to do an album of guitar players that was my favorite guitar players, and I was going to call it Lone Star Secrets way back in the 80s, and I never got it done. And this is kind of my friend from high school, Eric Johnson, plays on a Zachary Zach song, which is a band that I grew up with him from Corpus. They were on the Nuggets, a punk Nuggets album, you know. They were a great band. They were like the Yardbirds.
Is that like Bad Girl? Is that the Zachary Zach song, Bad Girl?
They did, yes. Yes, Bad Girl. They also had I Need You, which was a Kinks song. They cut that. But one of their singles was called Face to Face. And my friend Eric Johnson plays on that. And then I cut Street Fighting Man, which is my favorite Stone song. And that's my friend Jake Andrews from Austin. He's playing on that. I did produce an album for him. And then the Gary Myrick track, I Can See for Miles. That was my I bought that single by The Who when I was a kid. And I loved that song. It's my favorite Who song. So I wanted to do that. And I'd never sung it before. I sang it when we cut it. And it just kind of worked.
And then there's then the other song that I cut on there is with I love to say one of my childhood what I would call heartthrobs is BJ Thomas. I cut a song by him on Cool Water, which is on the ballad the Gunfighter Ballads album, Marty Robbins album. That was my favorite country album when I was growing up as a kid.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think the Sons of the Pioneers did that originally, Cool Water.
Yeah, Sons of the Pioneers. Yeah. Exactly.
Now my understanding is that is like the final recording that BJ Thomas did. Is that true or not?
As far as I know it is. Yeah. As far as I know. Yeah. Yeah. So he came here to LA. We did it. So I said we were lucky we were able to do it because then he passed away.
Right. So. Well, Carla, thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Well, thank you so much, Manfred.
Hey, absolutely. Well, we're going to take a listen now to your version of I Can See for Miles as Carla Olson off of Half Harmony Will Travel, Volume 3 in Little Steven's Underground Garage. For a cover of The Who's I Can See for Miles. That's Carla Olson in Little Steven's Underground Garage off her album Half Harmony Will Travel Volume 3. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Carla for joining me on today's Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing and editing our podcast. Last year, Omnivore Records reissued The Council's 1998 album Global. The famed 60s band continues to be active, and we'll find out what all they've been up to when I'm joined by founding member Bob Kausel on our next Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.